So thank you, everybody, for joining us today. This is going to be an interesting conversation because there's definitely a few evolving things. Three specifically, maybe four, if we get stuck into it. We'll see how far we go. So do you want to start off with the top story here around the new jobs report data that's come through? Because it seems like it's not that good news, but there's probably a little bit to unpack there, right?
Yeah, I don't know yet. No one's sure yet whether it's good news or bad news is the honest truth. So last Friday, we get, I think it's once a month, we get the JOLTS report out of the US. So that's job openings. And that's a survey where they send it out to all businesses in the US. And they're using that to take a view as to how many jobs were created the prior month. It's a really important sign of how strong the economy is and what that's doing to unemployment. Last Friday morning, New Zealand time, last Friday morning, American time, the latest survey for the month of August came out, and it was pretty bad. The US economy created 142,000 jobs versus an expectation of 165,000. This implies that the unemployment rate is about to tick up and is starting to tick up kind of stronger, further and faster than previously anticipated. 142,000 job openings. In fact, actually, at the same, that's probably less than the number of jobs that are being destroyed every month as well. So that kind of definitely a sign of a contracting workforce. And that's the lowest number that we have had since, I think it was since April 2020. So a long way through this expansion. We're petrified. So NASDAQ was down 2.8% on Friday. Off the back of it, Russell 2000 down, S&P 500 down. And I think it was kind of a really interesting one, right? Where we started. Was it good news? Was it bad news? We're not really too sure. Let's interpret the good news side of it. The good news side of it is the economy is clearly slowing. Mm. And with kind of less job creation, that's going to take pressure off wages because as unemployment rises, and that's going to make it easier and easier for the Fed to get their head around this kind of zero to or this low inflation world. And all of a sudden, not only does it firm up the idea that we're going to go through a 25 basis point fall later in this month, but potentially for a lot of people, it kind of said, hold on a sec, does that mean we're actually at 50 basis points? Bad news, so those that are looking out and a bit scared about markets and valuations at the moment, they took the bad news side of it, which is, hold on a sec, are we celebrating that the economy is slowing? Why are we accelerating an uplift in unemployment? Doesn't that mean that we're potentially heading into recession? So kind of a bit of a replay of the cycle that we saw at almost exactly the same point the month before, which is, hey, economic data, we all agree the economy is slowing. What we can't agree on is that good news or bad news, recession versus kind of just enough to kind of get our interest rates down. Yeah, and it's an interesting day.
Yeah, and there's parallels between what's happening in the US and what's happening in New Zealand that we'll dig into as we go. But just going back to the jobs data that's come in. So 142,000 new jobs compared to 160 to 165, down significantly. About a quarter at times throughout 2024, about a quarter of these jobs have come from government. So one question that I wonder, and we've kind of already seen the other side of this in New Zealand, and stuff has been stripped out of government spending significantly, and we've seen the impact, and we are seeing the impact of that here in New Zealand. We're there in the US, they haven't seen that yet. And I just wonder how much political interference there might be around some of this data. That's just one little marker. And then the other thing is job cuts. So it's one thing to talk about, hey, there's less new jobs coming up, but then the job cuts, they're up by, I think in August, cuts at US companies generally were up 193% compared to July. So that's huge, right? And almost half of that came from the tech sector. So that speaks to another evolving story, which is connected to the Magnificent Seven, which is really the Magnificent One. And I just wonder where that one goes too. So yeah, like what do you think that idea though, that there's some maybe political interference or they're trying to goose the numbers a little bit to make the economy look a bit better than what it probably really is in the US? Do you think there's an element of truth in that?
Probably. I do think that process started, to be fair, that process started in 2008. We finally learned fiscal stimulus and we never really backed away from it. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, what do we expect when we've got an economy in the US at the moment? They're running a deficit. I think it's about 6%, 7% of GDP. Kind of, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, we launched the $1.3 trillion, sorry, it was 3 years ago now. We launched the $1.3 trillion stimulus package of Inflation Reduction Act, which was actually spend a whole lot more money and then somehow...
It's the Inflation Act.
Yeah. So I think what we are seeing is actually... So do I think it's short-term kind of commandering and short-term trying to jiggle the economy? No. But I think it is the result of kind of a growing government and growing government involvement in our kind of economy, right? And there's no question that that is happening. And when we've got all over the world, and this is not just a New Zealand thing, this is clearly all over the world, but when we've got economies running such massive, or governments, sorry, running such massive deficits, what do we expect? And I think that's been the learning over the last almost 20 years is going, don't worry about it. If the private sector kind of falls short, then we'll just get the public sector to kind of kind of pick up the slack. So I don't think this has got anything to do with the election. But I do think that it's definitely kind of part of that drive of the kind of fiscal irresponsibility and the new government approach that we're kind of starting to see over the world for the last little while.
It's kind of like a neo-Keynesianism sort of concept where, the government can step in times of difficulty to stimulate the economy through injecting more spending, through creating more jobs and creating projects, basically dig a hole, fill it up again. Enough that doesn't actually solve the underlying productivity problem, but it does kind of kick the can further down the road, doesn't it?
It does. And I think, I mean, the political question is going to be really interesting in the coming week or two, right? Because when we start to have that real conversation around interest rates and Fed cuts, so I listened to a fascinating piece this morning going, actually kind of doomed if they do, doomed if they don't, right? I think we can all agree that is coming. What we can agree, though, is that there's a lot of debate around, do they get ahead of the curve? And if they want to get ahead of the curve, they need to go 50 points. Are they kind of happy just to kind of use the signaling and 25 basis points effectively as a signal, which kind of is an interesting, pretty fraught piece of analysis to start with. And then you overlay the politics, right? Because if he goes 50 basis points, and you look at what's just happened here in New Zealand with the confidence and with a whole lot of kind of, just what that will do to attitudes and a lot of that kind of thing in the US, I guarantee immediately we will get a kind of cry out of the Trump camp talking about how they're doing it to protect the current kind of world. But then if they only go 25 points, and because if they don't go 50 points in September, likely to go 25 points in November. And so kind of just after the election, and everyone's going to go, well, why did you wait for the election? You were kind of clearly playing politics back then. It's kind of one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't. And so I don't know what the right answer is, but it is fascinating because all of a sudden we are, I think, for the first time going to see the impact of politics truly impact Federal Reserve policy. And it's going to be interesting to see how these institutions navigate that and whether they can keep their trust through this process as well.
That's probably the most critical thing in all of this, right, is that regardless of how cynical I know I certainly sound at times when it comes to central banks, really important that there is a degree of faith. So I kind of love the idea that most people are quite ignorant of what actually goes on, because if they really understood what was going on, they would lose confidence. And confidence is kind of what is the underlying value behind our currency. And so if there's loss of faith in these institutions, then it's where I think we have a lot more societal problems than what we do right now. So it's weird, right? But it's ignorance is bliss.
100%. And so then that drives me to kind of, and this is us going off script away from what we're talking points, but it drives me back to New Zealand, right? Because I was thinking about this a lot over the last kind of week or two. What's really interesting, so we sit there and we go, hey, the Reserve Bank have done a massive backflip since May. Arguable. I personally think that the data justifies the backflip, and I think actually they should be commended to for listening to the data versus kind of sticking to their horses. But then I was kind of going through my mind, and someone said to me the other day, they go, do you realize that actually every single government project has stopped and gone on hold because it's subject to some form of review? Because it basically current government approach is just stop everything that Labor were doing and then figure out later what we're going to do. And so what that means is kind of, and I went there and I go, oh, it's really interesting. But actually, in the last kind of 18 months, and we've had our housing market is now dead, right? And that's finally meant that a lot of that construction work and a lot of that stuff is kind of dried right up. So we've kind of at the start of this year and over the last probably 4 to 6 months, that backlog has finally come through. And all of a sudden, if you want to get a builder, you want to get a tradie, there's thousands of them out there that are looking for work because it's finally stopped. The government level, there was, it's not just roads, it's not just all of that kind of stuff that was going on. Actually, the government has stopped a huge number of projects, whether that be school kind of upgrade program that's been stopped, and they kind of, that's subject to a review at the moment. Whatsoever, huge amount of infrastructure spend going on in that area, where they're building new hospitals, upgrading hospitals, facilities, all of that. That stopped, subject to review. Stopped, subject to review. Light rail, stopped. There's a whole series of projects that have kind of, they've gone, stop. Rightly or wrongly, I don't have a view as to whether those are the wrong or the right decisions. But they have had an impact, right? Because Three Waters is another one. And when you go, there's just a lot of stuff that's gone, fuck, there's a lot of people that were employed and a lot of things that were happening, and we've stopped it. Plus, we've got the 7.5% spending cut that's happened across non-frontline spend. And so when you think there and go, the government actually makes up about 35% of our GDP, so 35% of our economy is actually government spending. All of this is happening. And it kind of, this is all the stuff that they started and then trained in October, November. It took a good 6-9 months for it to actually kind of stop. You can't just say stop and then all of a sudden things stop immediately. Are we really that surprised that our economy's hit a brick wall when the three things that have been dry, or, and then we've got the interest rate piece, right? So let's be brutally honest. The four things that have driven New Zealand over the last 4 years are government, government spending, government infrastructure, housing, and ultra low interest rates. We've taken away those four things. And of course, the economy is crumbling like a house of cards.
Yeah, totally. That is the... But that's the superficial nature of how, like you say, since 2008, that's kind of like the superficial way that we've created growth, is we've basically goosed the numbers, I think. And there's no underlying productivity. Admittedly, though, like a lot of that investment in infrastructure, sorely needed. Yeah. Yeah. And that is really important that we get onto these things. It's not like these aren't important things, but there's no direct impact in terms of creating something of value at the other end of the spend. That is the definition of inflationary spending. Yep. And government adds almost, in my extreme perspective, be that government adds no value at all. What's that?
Extreme from you, never.
No, never. And this is just a perspective. It's not necessarily what I really believe, or is it? But the more government steps out of the way and lets the free market actually take care, it ain't going to be pretty way. It's efficient. Same thing with monetary policy. The more we intervene with interest rates and try to, you know, manipulate where the economy goes, more distortions you create.
I agree on monetary policy. I think we're seeing this in a crump. Like, again, the woke Greyland socialist versus the...
Go ahead. You can label me.
I couldn't actually think of a name, to be perfectly honest. That's the problem, because... I would have called you hard right, because actually you don't have any of those tendencies. Libertarian, that's the word.
Yeah, that's probably the least offensive. Yeah.
Versus the libertarian. And yeah. Look, I think we are seeing in a number of sectors and a number of parts of the New Zealand economy, electricity being one of them, where actually we probably have taken a laissez-faire approach, and I'm not sure that's been the right answer, right? Who knows? Time will tell, and I think there is a middle ground to go. Yeah. It's going to be fascinating, because I do think what we are currently going through, others are going to go through as well, right? The only difference is that we have politicians that for some reason believe we need to keep to our 30-30 rule, which is 30% debt to GDP, that one I disagree with, because I do think we can afford and sustain higher debt levels, and 30% of taxes to GDP, that one I do firmly agree with, because that one is the right answer. And in order to deliver to that, we're going to need significant productivity improvements for our public service, or changes to the benefits expectations.
Well, let's stay on this theme of big government, inefficiency, opaque reporting. Talk to me about what's going on with China's economic struggles.
Well, China, the story that just cannot break out of its kind of fiscal malaise, right? So we've talked about it a little bit over the last couple of years. Years, actually, it's true. Yeah. So I think the kind of increasingly there's a view that ever since those Shanghai lockdowns in 2021, Chinese economy's just never really been able to get back on its feet. So remember, China economy did pretty well through the first half of COVID. 2021, all of a sudden there was the draconian lockdown in Shanghai, people not allowed to leave their apartments, being arrested for leaving their apartments. I think it caused a huge amount of hardship in that economy. It did a significant dent in the trust factor of the Chinese people towards the government. The manufacturing also caused a massive dent from a lot of the corporates because the manufacturing base was massively impacted as well, right? You kind of, all of a sudden, if people weren't allowed to leave their houses, it meant only critical factories were allowed to stay open. So it dealt, and then that happened. Plus, at the same time, we had the crackdown on the big successful tech companies. So there was a lot of internal and external kind of unease about dealing with China. And you had the world of Trump era, where all of a sudden we've kind of moved to a geopolitical competition. It's kind of an East versus West argument all over again, China versus the rest of the world. And then kind of all of a sudden we've got a pretty difficult economy that internationally it's becoming further and further removed from the West. Levels are falling. As we move to an investment in the country is falling. We've got falling, we've got reduced investment, reduced technology as a whole lot of blocks are there. And then reduced exports due to kind of trade barriers and all of that kind of stuff. No surprises here. What does this mean? It means that we have a kind of not quite shrinking, but in terms of the Chinese economy, where they're currently growing at about 4.7, 4.8% per year, but that's materially below the 6% target of the government. And then there's a lot of people going, well, actually, the data is so opaque, we've got no idea what the real data is, so who knows what 4.8% is real or not, or is that just the number that means that it works? We've also seen some very, very negative sentiment data coming out of businesses and consumers recently as well. Final piece to the puzzle, which is I find fascinating, happened kind of all of a sudden, we've got this inflation data, which actually looks as though the Chinese economy might be going into a deflationary period, which is, I think, really interesting, right? Because you've got this high growth economy for the better part of the last 25 years or 30 years that's really driven a big chunk of global growth. And what does that mean? They might be able to keep on growing. Actually, deflation means that people are no longer getting wealthier. People are going to be hoarding their savings with the expectation that they get cheaper as well. And I think this will pose some material risks to the rest of the global economy. Far and away, New Zealand's largest trading partner, Australia, have had a kind of a 30-year export-led boom, basically driven by Chinese insatiable demand for commodities. And then where does all this take the rest of us? The final piece of my rant, which I think, as I was thinking about this and reading the data, here my big question is, have they reached a Japanese moment? I remember where we go, Japan, the wonder child of probably post-World War II era, all the way through to the mid-90s. And so, to be fair, that lasted 50 years rather than kind of 30. But then all of a sudden, the crisis hit. They realized they had a whole lot of excess and a whole lot of bubbles in that economy. They overinvested in property, too much housing, and secular decline in population growth. And I kind of sit there, and as I was thinking through that story, the whole lot of kind of bubbles that went off in my head going, that actually sounds very similar to where China is at the moment, right? Where we've got massive excess housing, property bubbles that have happened and are slowly being deflated. And we've got an economy that a population base that over the next 40 years is expected to halve. Remember last year was the first year that the Chinese population actually shrunk. So a lot of things to think about and particularly scary when 20-25% of your exports go to China.
Is it? Just curious on a couple of things here before we even begin. So stagnant growth, we have demographic challenges, and then we have deflation. Deflation is interesting because we have a problem with, or we have had a problem with inflation. So it's all about understanding what happens when inflation gets out of control, but flip it around, reverse it. What happens in deflation is that you can also have these deflationary spirals as well. I think about the bank failures. It was this year, almost 40 different banks have effectively vanished. They've obviously been consolidated. I think it is something, don't quote me on this, but I think there's something like 40% of all of the loans on the books of these smaller and rural banks around China are thought to be non-performing loans. Wow. These are bad debts, right? And imagine if that led to a domino default destruction of any sort of situation, that just puts that deflationary death spiral on acid. It just goes crazy. Then the demographic thing, I was just wondering as well, we've seen in the West, so let's say America, Australasia. We've seen that immigration has been used as a very effective tool, again, to goose the numbers, to actually almost offset the demographic decline. I just wonder if we would ever see a situation where in Japan or China starts to open up and help make it very, very enticing for the West to move in. And we have this big swaparoonie going on here. It would solve some of their problems. And they are more than capable of doing that, fill up all their empty high rises that they built over the last few decades. Do you think we would ever see that?
Eventually we have to, I guess, because we know that's what the long-term answer is for these countries. They've got the infrastructure. Problem is, immigration has always been just a massive no-no for these countries, right?
Yeah, why is that?
And look, I actually don't know. It's just the cultural piece, I think. I mean, you look in Japan where Korean diaspora, who got moved there forcibly in World War II and before World War II, when it was effectively a colony of Japan, still not accepted as normal citizens. So look, it's just going to require a massive cultural shift for that to happen. You are right. It probably has to get there, right? Because if conversely, the opposite of New Zealand, where we've got an infrastructure, it's built for 4 million people and we've got 5 million people with an extra 200,000 a year coming here. They've got an infrastructure built for a billion people and 100 million people leaving. So yeah, you are right. It has to get there. It's just a matter of kind of how do you change those cultural norms? It also requires politicians being brave and challenging the status quo. And what do we know about politicians? They hate doing that.
The people what they want, not what they need.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, though, I think. And yeah, New Zealand, where this becomes relevant for us here in New Zealand is that either directly with China or indirectly through Australia, China is one of our largest trading partners. So if they get into severe economic funk, and we're going to pay for it effectively, but on the same page, further down the page, the cost of all the stuff that we import from China may actually go down because the cost of labor might go down, the cost of production might go down as a result. You know, for good or for bad in that country, it means that we actually buy some cheap stuff again. So I'm not saying that makes it okay, but it's just interesting just to see these dynamics, right?
Look, it is, right? And I think it is going to be actually really hard to figure out where it all lands, just thinking out loud here. It's always dangerous. But as so I talked about the four things that have driven the New Zealand economy over the last 30 years. Actually, let's add China to that list as well, which is the other thing that's slowing and making material change from where it's been.
True. Okay. So we've covered two big topics already here. Take us to the
third, which was, as I look to remember, pulling out my list.
Interest rate cuts and commodity prices on my notes.
This was a fascinating article that I read and looked at the other day. Because I think, it was kind of quite contradictory, right? There is an increasing, so on one hand, we're saying inflation has stopped and that we're now in a world where we can afford to reduce interest rates and stimulate demand through the economy with lower interest rates. Because we no longer have an interest rate. We no longer have an inflation problem. On the flip side, a whole lot of economists and market strategists are saying, get ready for the next commodity boom because interest rates, low interest rates are going to drive a whole lot more spending. And therefore, we're likely to see a next surge in the gold price, higher oil, higher commodities in general. I thought this was really interesting, right? Because on one hand, we're saying inflation's not a problem. And then on the other hand, we're saying, hey, go invest in all these things because inflation's about to be a problem. And of course, the article was nowhere near that, but the analysis is nowhere near that blunt, but it is actually really interesting. And I guess kind of using gold as a barometer is a really interesting part of this, right? So gold currently sitting at $2,500 an ounce versus kind of 3 years ago, what it was about
$1,400.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a phenomenal return. And people saying, look, lower interest rates are only going to help that. Potentially, we're going to move into a world where people are now talking about $3,000 to $3,500 an ounce. And so oil, on the flip side, I think oil is, again, the question is, will lower interest rates drive a whole lot of demand through the economy? I'm skeptical based on a whole lot of the stuff that we're starting to see. Airlines are a good barometer of kind of what's happening on oil demand, and airlines are all of a sudden starting to report some pretty weak traffic numbers all around the world. So, but I just found it a fascinating piece of going, well, actually, if you're trying to inflation-proof your portfolio, what do you actually do, right? Do you kind of, and actually, kind of where I got to is some of those hard commodities are actually a really interesting place to play because you can go into kind of some of those real assets, so property, those kind of things. Real assets, though, are great in a lower interest rate environment. They're going to struggle in a high interest rate environment. Yeah, kind of gold, commodities, some of those areas, maybe the places where you do need to go and you do need to hide these times of uncertainty where we're not sure, does inflation break to the left, i.e. does it go lower? Actually, back to the government spending points that we talked about earlier and kind of the deglobalization of trade, does it actually go higher?
I think so. I'm going to say I think it will go higher for sure. But I think that is the question. Yeah. I like gold. I love the of Mr. T. I think he's the best, right? I think having a couple of gold bars lying around during this period of time probably isn't the stupidest thing you can do. But again, in the back of my mind is always this mantra, you know, it's a great date, but a terrible wife. Well, gold. And there are seasons where it can perform incredibly well, but then there are seasons where it's actually just really, really dangerous. But there's a fellow that I follow fairly closely. I've had him on my podcast a few times. His name is Gary Savage. Calls it as it is. He's kind of been pointing out for the last couple of weeks in particular that because of where we're at in the charts right now, where it's been over the $2,500 per ounce for a decent period of time and it's closed over that mark, it's quite likely to go quite higher. It's called a up and handle. So it is definitely looking very positive on the technicals, on the charts. And then when you look at the fundamentals and you consider what's the actual likelihood that the BRICS nations could actually pull this one off, we can see that Saudi and China are open to experimenting with new mediums of exchange with oil. We know that Russia and China are also keen to get things moving there. We know that in the East, gold is not a weird sort of thing that no one talks about. In the West, it is, though. But I kind of can see that changing. And even just this morning, I had another client reach out to me saying, I've got 100 grand to drop in precious metals. Where do I go? And that was not the first conversation I've had like that in probably a few weeks. So I think things are starting to change. And I don't know if it's maybe that's just random. And people start to kind of look at what the interest rates mean. Going down, yep, good. Like what you're saying with hard assets going up. There's uncertainty around what's going on. Where do you go? Can't really go to cash. You don't know what the inflation story is, and then overlay that with some geopolitical concerns at a very high level. So yeah, where would you put your money, right? You could put it into Bitcoin. Yeah, for sure. But it's still not, haven't had a huge amount of time yet to call that a proper safe haven asset as much as I'd like to. Gold is, I think, a good one. But the topic of Bitcoin or...
Can I ask one question, actually? It's just kind of when you kind of raised up there. One of the bits in gold, so apparently one of the key drivers of gold at the moment is central banks around the world buying it, right? Yeah. Because people are petrified about holding dollars after what happened to Russia. Question is, do we know how much that is? If so, we look at what happened with the Bitcoin ETFs. The Bitcoin ETFs bought a whole new buyer universe, right? That $25 billion over the first couple of months that went into them. And that pushed us from that kind of 40,000 to 60. Is this what's happened in gold? So we've gone from kind of, is it because that central bank buying that's driven that price up? Is question number one. Question number two is also then going, does that mean it's an ongoing? Because my understanding is the central banks will just buy and hold it, never sell, never do anything. They're the ultimate hodlers. What does that mean for pricing in the future?
I don't really understand one of those questions. can you tell me that?
The first question is, so central banks, do we know how much of the current buying is being done by central banks? Because central bank, my understanding is central banks are a big part of the current story, right? Gold story. Totally.
Yeah, they are. And I think that's been going on now for a few years. They've been quietly accumulating at these, what appears to be low historical prices. And there's a lot of can be expected murkiness coming out of China in terms of what their actual buying has been. But if you were to think about this at a nation state level, or even just above the nation state level at the central bank there, you had groups of very powerful organizations that wanted to shore up some buying power, keep some proper dry powder in reserve. They're not going to do it through treasuries. They're not going to do it through other foreign reserve. They're going to do it with a medium of exchange that they all have value in. And so my theory is that the reason why central banks are going on this gold buying binge is because they're gearing up for a change in the new monetary system that's inevitable. It will happen. It always happens whenever there's global conflict. So I think that they can see into the future enough, just like we can, that we know that there's a tussle going on and it will probably get worse. But at the end of that, there'll be a monetary reset of some sort. There always has been. Just look to the past, 19 earlier before that, Bretton Woods. So you're going to see that. So I think that's part of it. And then you were saying with the ETFs, I know there's a lot of speculation, or there has been over the years. JP Morgan has always been kind of the one that people point at without wanting to be too critical of them. There's a little bit of paper creation where there's more gold that are created through the exchange traded fund process. That's where Bitcoin, I think, has an advantage, because you can see on chain where the Bitcoin is, whereas we have no idea how much new supply is coming out of the ground. We have no idea really if it's in these unallocated vaults, gold. So yeah, there's probably more of a possibility that there could be a little bit more suppression of price by the powers that be, maybe depending on how conspiratorial you want to get. Maybe that's to assist banks in buying more gold. I don't know, but it feels like the time for the buying is done and now it's the time for the rest. And that's probably why seeing the price run up now, in my view. But hey, what do I know, right?
It's fair. I think it's a fair call. It'd be interesting to see.
I love that space. But hey, let's quickly finish up on gold. It's not gold. Let's finish up on Bitcoin. Digital gold, yeah. Because I think I was just saying to you before we hit record that I find it quite interesting how people who are very much into Bitcoin, that I follow anyway, they've gone real quiet. A few of them have complained that they've been shadow banned. I'm like, no, this is just what happens when people kind of go off the idea that Bitcoin is going to the moon. I've seen this so many times now where people's expectations get way ahead of themselves. They become so certain that we're going to hit 100 grand before the end of 2024 that when it's not going their way, they become despondent and just not look at anything. And I think that's kind of where we're at with Bitcoin and crypto generally, is that, yeah, it's I wouldn't say, hey, we're back into the bear market territory, but I think the initial enthusiasm that was kicked off with these ETFs at the beginning of 2024, I just wonder if maybe that has faded away now and we're back on the normal trajectory that we should be at post-halving, pre the next boom. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I find it really fascinating right now, right? I speak to a few people who are a bit confused as to why we haven't seen the takeoff. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, if you look at the core fundamentals, right, as much as you could say those words with crypto, but three big things, right? ETFs, they've come and they've worked. And there's no question, right? It's made that as an asset class, it's opened it up to a whole new world of investors. Very similar to what gold did back in 2008 when the first gold ETF launched. Yeah. We've had the Ethereum ETF launch, again, creating a biodiversity, working well. So we've actually got a world that we can now see that this, as an investment class, works, putting this through those ETFs, and that has made it a whole lot easier. We've got two US politicians who are basically, look, Trump falling over himself, kind of lure into the crypto industry. I didn't actually realize this, but he's selling NFTs left, right, and center, and he's kind of got a whole lot of investments in this space, which is clearly why he's pushing it so hard all of a sudden. Even Kamala Harris, who's saying, hold on a sec, yeah, I'm probably not going to loosen up and I'm not going to be as forthright as Donald Trump on this, but she has got Mark Cuban, a big crypto investor, as one of her biggest supporters, and he would not be doing that unless he saw that it was in his best interest. She has also come out loud and clear and said, hey, look, going to give specific proposals, but I am happy to say that the cryptocurrency industry, it is an important industry and I want it to remain based in the US, and I'm going to make sure that we do enough to kind of allow that to happen, right? And to be fair for her, that's about as deep policy as you're ever going to get, because she's clearly staying well away from ever giving anything too tangible or real. So kind of go, when you put those three factors together, those should be going really, really well, but it's not. So to me, what it comes back to is it comes back to the risk on, risk off trade-off. And this I find fascinating right now, right? We've talked about it last 2 weeks. So I've been absolutely petrified, right? We're a little bit of bad news and we have these minus 3% days. And that we're seeing more and more consistently. And I suspect we'll have a whole lot more of them in the coming weeks and coming months as well. Fortunately, people still haven't quite got their head around Bitcoin, still seen as a barometer of risk. Until we can move the markets and the economies off this knife edge, I think it's going to be a real struggle, to be blunt. That's the issue that we have right now. And that's kind of, to me, it's less about the crypto fundamentals, because usually crypto fundamentals are actually looking really strong right now. It's more the broader fundamentals that I think are creating the uncertainty.
Demand in particular, right? Like sometimes we just get fatigued too, right? Like being risk on for a significant period of time, just making that default assumption that certain sectors are just always going to go up. I think as time goes on, you kind of get reminded that the Mr. Market really is in charge, and he slaps you around every now and then if you try to get too clever. I think, though, that the moment there's probably a little bit of fatigue setting in, especially in the crypto community. I'm not saying that as a bad thing. I actually kind of think that's a good thing, that the eyes get taken off of the price. The eyes come off the price and they go on to building projects, because there are amazing developments happening within the broader ecosystem. Solana is one of the assets that I follow, and the partnerships going on with things like MasterCard, different ways of paying Apple. Like, there's a lot of developments that are going on that will make crypto type digital assets very sought after. And I don't mean that as like, hey, this is the next thing that's going to the moon. I just mean it's going to be a tool that people just use and consume. Right now, we're still stuck in the headspace that it is a speculative asset. Buy it, wait for number to go up. I think that's fraught for so many reasons, but we're starting to see building going on that needs to occur before wide adoption actually kicks in. That adoption will kick in, and I think it'll happen swiftly. There has to be building going on, and we can't really build when we're just fixated on price, because we're just speculating. It's like anything, right? Like, we want to speculate in property. Yeah, just buy, hold, wait for number to go up. That's not the same as actually producing more houses. And we have that same dynamic happening in the crypto space, where you actually have to focus more on the building rather than actually just building up portfolio. But fascinating. Let's keep an eye on that, because post-election crypto should be interesting, because for different reasons, Trump and Kamala will do different things, both potentially bullish for crypto assets in different ways. So that'll be interesting to watch, right?
Fascinating to watch. And more than anything, coming back to probably the theme of this podcast, right? Politicians do whatever they can to be popular and be voted in. And at the moment, being positive on crypto appears to be one of those things.
Yeah, who knew? Easy. All right. Well, that was a good chat today, Rupert. We'll look forward to doing this again next week.
Thanks, Darcy. And speak again next week.
Yep.